thank you for joining the Black News Interview Series. My name is John Wood, and our guest today is Mr. Ted Hayes. Now, Ted Hayes, for anybody who knows him, knows that he is, to some, a controversial figure. But he's done so much in his life, and his achievements are many and notable. It's difficult for me to know where to start off exactly. Known to many as the Rasta Republican, Ted Hayes is a successful activist on behalf of the homeless. He, in fact, was the founder of Dome Village in Los Angeles. He's a political activist, a noted critic of illegal immigration, founder also of the Compton Cricket Club, which I believe has toured Great Britain and Australia. And he is also author of the book The Other Side of the Pyramid, which is available at tedhayes.us. In addition to this, Ted Hayes identifies himself as being the voice of the descendants of the chattel slaves. And I think that feeds into the point of our discussion, because one of the things we're going to be talking about today is the identity of Black Americans. What is our identity? So, Ted, tell us, if you will, what does it mean for you to be the voice of the descendants of the chattel slaves? Who are the chattel slaves, for those who don't know?
Well, first of all, John, I just want to say I am humbled, and I deeply appreciate you as a young man and your crew there at your station to ask me, the street urchin, my opinion on things going on in our country, the world, and particularly as it relates to us, so-called African-American, Negro, colored people, whatever, Black folks as a people. So thank you for allowing me to express my viewpoints.
Oh, thank you, Ted. Thank you for being
here. It's always encouraging for me. I'm 61 years old now. I just turned 61 in March. God has really blessed me with a great body, great metabolism, and all that kind of good stuff. And that's why I could play cricket and those kinds of things. And in my short 61 years on this planet, and a few years consciously on this planet, it's very encouraging to see when young people in their teens and 20s, et cetera, early 30s, get up and get involved seriously. I remember in the 60s when I first got involved, the whole Black, what I call not revolution, but cultural revolution of the 1960s.
Right,
and
right.
The peace movement, young people, you know. And when I was out recently seeing all the Occupy Wall Street stuff going on, I always encourage the young people, no matter what race or color they are, even if they're in total opposite viewpoints of mine, I'd say, hey, man, I'm glad to see you out expressing your viewpoints. So it's good to hear from you, John, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, we appreciate you being here, Ted, absolutely. And hopefully people will heed your call and get involved one way or another. Just don't sit on the sidelines. Yeah.
Yep.
But what does it mean, Ted, that chattel says? What does the word chattel mean?
Chattel means property, human property.
Right.
And that's what our ancestors became in America, was not just mere slaves. Slavery has been with humanity since the days of Babylon, when our people invented, the Hamitic people invented the practice. But, and there's all kinds of slavery. But this kind of slavery was, from what we can gather, was unprecedented in all of human history, where a whole body politic of peoples were owned as living human property. And in fact, that, you know, not only were you owned, but when you had a child, if a couple or a woman had a child, that child was also owned. You know, you're talking about birthright to own it, birthright slavery. Well, there it is. So
right.
That's chattel slavery.
I see.
And
the total ownership of a human being and that human being's lineage. Would it be fair to say that the brutality in this type of slavery was a bit more severe than it had even been in other cultures and other periods of global history?
Yes, sir. You're spot on, young man. Absolutely correct. And this is what a lot of people in America today, the immigrants today, the descendants of immigrants, or those who have the immigrant lineage, do not understand about us. They keep saying to us, get over it. That happened hundreds of years ago. Haven't y'all been here longer than us? Why aren't you? See, and you know, they don't really understand that chattel slavery did psychological as well as emotional damage for generations to come, generations yet to come. What we're seeing today with folks, they call the African Americans, which I call the descendants of the chattel slaves. What you're seeing today is the aftermath of slavery, which is worse than chattel slavery itself. More people have lost their lives, our people, in the aftermath of slavery since 1865, particularly in these recent two decades, than all of the period of chattel slavery.
And you think that owes in large part to the psychological reverberations that we're still feeling?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. Any psychoanalyst, and I'm not one. I just, you know, I'm a stump dude. I just dig around and use some common sense, and Lord, show me things, you know.
Right.
But any professional psychoanalyst, a psychiatrist will tell you, a sociologist, you can't treat a people for 235 years as subhuman and expect them to perform as normal human beings someday when you happen to set them free.
I think you've said something that'll reverberate with a lot of the people listening. The idea that we should just sort of get over it after several hundred years. I mean, there's an argument to be made that maybe we should adopt this political attitude or that attitude, perhaps we should focus more on bettering ourselves than complaining about this, that, or the other. But certainly, people outside the just to borrow the label for a second, the African-American or black American experience, have a difficult time just understanding, because they don't have historic proximity to the experience, just what the long-lasting repercussions of that pain and trauma are even today, and how it accounts for the breakdown of the black family structure and the difficulty we have in really rising through the societal structure that we may have built it on the sweat of our backs, but we didn't really to construct it in the active sense.
And I would encourage your listeners to do some research. Go to my website, tedhaise.us, and you scroll down. It's an old-fashioned website now. It ain't hip like yours. It's old school. But you scroll. It's easy to read, though. I write in basic 12th grade high school style, okay? But you read.
We should
scroll
all be
down.
Able to get it,
what?
We should all be able to get it, then.
Yeah, you should be able to get that. You should be able to get it. Yeah, and you scroll down and look for the Martin Luther King Jr. Dream Act 2013.
Okay.
Now, that's been around since 2010, but that's okay. We work it year by year. And you read that because it takes you into who we are as a people and what our constitutional rights as well as human rights are in this country. And it focuses around the 14th Amendment, Section 1. And it focuses around the Civil Rights Act of 1866 with its 10 sections, which I believe is the Rosetta Stone of the 14th Amendment, because the 14th Amendment was birthed out of the Civil Rights Act of 1866. The point I'm making is the people who put that together, the Republicans, white Republican men, in Congress, Capitol Hill, recognize that this people, regardless of their skin color and race, put that aside, these are human beings. These folks have been held in chattel slavery for 235 years. Now, we're going to free them with the 13th Amendment. We fought the war, we freed them, but there is damage that's going to go on for generations to come. Therefore, we will write an act, the Civil Rights Act of 1866, and we will codify it into the Constitution of the United States via the 14th Amendment. That way, a future Congress down the road several generations from now will not be able to remove this fundamental foundational act that is to guarantee the eternal survival or the long-term survival of these people who have been so damaged down through the generations. And please go and read that, because it'll for me, man, it opened my eyes and my head stopped spinning, and I got it. And it's simple.
Right.
Very simple.
Right. So, Ted, when you say that you're the or seeking to be the voice of the chattel slaves, and you talk about the these ideals, these principles that are enshrined in the 14th Amendment, written, as you say, by white Republican men, and you paint this picture of the liberties that these these promised to us. But of course, you've also said at the same time that chattel slavery, which also was visited upon us by the hands of white men, either of whatever party at the time. You understand what I'm saying, of course.
Yes, yes.
European men. Isn't there a contradiction here when we look at our experience here in the United States of America? On the one hand, there is the idea set forth in the Declaration of Independence that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness,
uh-huh.
that we are created equal.
Uh-huh.
And yet we have been brutalized
uh-huh.
by the same nation of the same race of people
uh-huh.
who set forth these high-minded ideas. When you're speaking for the chattel slaves, you're trying
uh-huh.
to help give us a vision. I mean,
uh-huh.
how can you reconcile these two things for black people? How can we embrace a nation that is, you know, brought us here under such contradictions?
Well, there's a lot of pieces to that, and actually, you know, if you would read my book, The Other Side of the Pyramid, that will also stop your head from spinning around, because you begin to realize that our struggle really doesn't have that much to do with the white man. The proverbial white man is a sideshow. That is a byproduct of our relationship as a African peoples, West Central African peoples, on the continent, when we were at war with each other and we messed around with the Muslims and put each other on them slave ships. And the proverbial white man made the stupid mistake as a Judeo-Christian of buying into what was going on the mother continent, and which brought a curse upon them because of what they should not have bought into the slave trade, but they did. And unfortunately, when we got here, we came here as slaves, treated brutally, of course, on the Middle Passage. But it was in
black trading slaves to white Christians, basically.
Yeah, they were trading us off. They were, you know, all the different ethnicities. The issue wasn't about race at all originally. That's been a really unfortunate fabricated story. The conflict in Africa was ethnic, just like Europeans or Asians or Indians in India or America. They all look pretty much like each other, but it's ethnic conflicts that they have with each other. So we so-called black folks had ethnic conflicts with each other. We had no qualms about beating each other down, enslaving one another in various forms of slavery. Now, when the white folks showed up, primarily the Roman Catholics first, the Spaniards and the Portuguese under the blessing of the Roman Catholic Church, and also the Jews began to send their ships, they ignored the biblical concept that the love of money is the root of all evil. This was an evil thing, this slavery thing. Do not purchase into it. And they did. And of course, that's what got them in trouble today. Unfortunately, down the road now, I'm looking for the document right now. Apparently, in 1640, there was a black man from, I think it was Angola, and he came to Jamestown with the early group. He was an indentured servant, and he eventually got his freedom and ended up owning quite a lot of land and ended up owning indentured servants himself. And he had some white ones and some African ones. And so at the end of the indentured servitude, you know, he let the white guys go, but he kept the black fella. So the African guy took the black fella, the African fella, to court and said, I want to be set free because I've done my time. And the court ruled in favor of the black owner that this man would be human living property for the rest of his life. Lo and behold, it was a black man who initiated chattel slavery. Now, that's something.
Are you saying there was no African slave ownership? I mean, that is, say, no white people in the New World at that point had owned black slaves?
No, at that point, it was all indentured servitude.
I see.
It was all this. Now, I read something from Lerone Bennett years ago in a book he called Before the Mayflower, I think it was. I'm not sure which one it was. But he was talking about there was indentured servitude, yeah, in Jamestown, all those areas. But around 1630, they began to restrict the movement of black men. We were not allowed to have weapons and things like that, so that we had to become dependent upon white folks for our needs, which indebted us. We could not testify in court against whites, and we couldn't testify in court against each other, and we definitely couldn't testify in court against white folks. So we were losing out then. And if you recall, a lot of the white indentured servants or slaves would escape and go somewhere else and mingle in with white folks because they looked like white folks. Indians would escape, and they go over the hill to some other Indians and escape. But we had a distinctive mark on us different than all other people, particularly our kinky hair, you know. So that made us stand out. And so the black fellow, I'm just reasoning now, the black fellow, his last name is Johnson, recognized, I can hold this cat. And he was like his ancestors on the continent. I don't care what color you is. Yeah, you're the enemy. You were the other ethnicity. I'ma own you. And of course, stupid white people, they should have said no. That's not according to the Declaration of Independence. We're trying to get away from this. No, we deny you the right to own this man for the rest of his life. That's wrong. But oh no, they saw too what the profit motive.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't think that these white people were thinking religiously as much as they were thinking economically.
Teach, my brother. That's what they saw. And in fact, you know, listeners, if you go and study the good ship Jesus, it was commissioned by Queen Elizabeth I, and that was the first British ship to bring people from Africa to the United States. Now, it was a horrific story that happened because this ship took like 700 of our folks aboard, and about only 300 of them survived. It was a huge fiasco. So when the captain got back to England, Queen Elizabeth, she read him the riot act, was ready to throw him in the dungeon. She says, "Don't you know you're going to bring the wrath of God down upon this royal kingdom by participating in the slave trade?" And they said, "Wait a minute, slow down. When they began to explain to her the profit in slavery, she changed her mind, and that captain became a hero. The good ship Jesus.
Right. Well, you know, God and Mammon, you have to choose between one or the other, I think. And it's a difficult choice for people to make. Once the love of money interferes, so to speak, I think people lose sight of a lot of things.
Point I'd like to make about chattel slavery real quick here. And this whole issue of what I call the lineage or those who are the inheritors of immigration, okay, of that heritage. Tavis Smiley and Cornel West have been going around the country talking about Obama and Romney and folks not paying attention to poor folks in this country, which is absolutely correct. They all talk about the middle class. But then he goes on to say that it's time that we poor folks all come together, the poor folks. Black people, all poor folks. Well, I took issue with that. And you will too when you understand this. Because we are not mere poor people. We black folks. We are people who are descendants of chattel slavery. Our poverty has nothing to do with the poverty that the immigrants go through. Those people came to this country willingly. They came with the American dream gleam in their eyes. They came with the willingness to suffer for generations for their children to come after them. So they had that. And if they become successful and fail, start over, great. That's up to them. They chose that. They came on the Mayflower. And Cornel West and Smiley are doing is they're putting us on the Mayflower. We didn't come on the Mayflower. You cannot compare us together. What's good for the goose is not good for the gander. And you cannot put them on the good ship Jesus. These are two stocks of American people. There's only two stocks of American people. Those who came in this continent willingly and those who came here unwillingly. And we came here unwillingly as slaves and ultimately morphed into chattel slaves. So you cannot compare the two.
Well, it's obvious that we have a different immigration experience than Latin American, European, and Asian American immigrants because we never emigrated. We were brought here.
Yes.
And I was talking to somebody on the Blackist staff not long ago about the difference, and I hope I don't offend you or any of our listeners, but the difference between the work ethic among some Hispanic youth and some Black youth. And there's a perception that some Black youth just don't work as hard as some Hispanic youth. But I pointed out the fact that, of course, our experience in coming here is a bit different. They came here to work, and we were brought here to work against our will. So I think
exactly.
The psychological repercussions are a bit different. I mean, I can understand, I think, Tavis and Cornel West might suggest that Blacks and other poor people might have some similar political interests just because of their economic station, you know. I don't think that's unreasonable, but I think that you're right that our experience is so different that Black Americans or the descendants of the Chattel slaves, our personal remedy has to be unique because our experience is so different.
Absolutely correct, young man. That's
right.
The point. See, this is why, okay, check this out, people. It's why I'm calling myself the voice, the rising voice of the descendants of the Chattel slaves and not Black people, African Americans. You know why I'm doing that? Because you got Hispanic Latinos, illegal aliens, running into this country, claiming civil rights, benefits, and lineage and heritage. They don't have any standing there, and they say, "Well, look at my skin color." What? And then you got people saying, "Well, we're minorities like the Blacks." What? The gays? Well, just like the what? And see. So when you study this out, the people put together 13th to 14th to 15th Amendment and the Constitution. Those people did that with that understanding that this is not about skin color or race, even though it is mentioned. It is about the unique experience by which these people were brought into the United States of America. And until the United States of America finishes its business with these people, it cannot address anyone else on this level whatsoever until these people are met. And
right.
That has been the fatal flaw. I don't understand why Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, all these ministers, all these Black liberal and conservative, constitutional and Declaration of Independence experts have not figured this out.
Right. And to say something about the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, really quick, wherever a person stands on immigration or illegal immigration, I think it's important that we be clear about what the 14th Amendment says. And what it tells us is that those who are born or who are under the jurisdiction of the United States, naturalized or born under the jurisdiction of the United States, will receive citizenship. And, of course, the impetus for that was the emancipation of the slaves and allowing us to have citizenship conferred upon us because we are born under the jurisdiction of the United States. The Supreme Court and other people have since then interpreted that or sort of omitted the key word jurisdiction from the 14th Amendment to be able to justify the notion that if a person is to come to the United States of America, even illegally, even in contradiction of our immigration law, and have a child, that child is automatically conferred citizenship. But in my opinion, and I'm not even expressing a political opinion, I'm just expressing a legal opinion, that term jurisdiction can only apply to those who are under the legal jurisdiction of the United States of America. That is, if your parents were not born here, if they came here illegally, they're under the legal jurisdiction of their home country, not this country. But there seems to be a little bit of a political motivation on the part of some to ascribe that legal status to those to whom, to me anyway, and I think maybe you agree, it clearly does not apply.
You're absolutely correct. And let me add something to this for you. And if you guys, again, if you go and read my material, I talk about this there.
Right.
There's
and
something.
I just want to say that that's in no way an anti-Hispanic statement. That's just a simple legal statement. You know?
Yeah, absolutely correct.
You and I both admire the fact that these people are coming here with the American dream gleaming in their eye, as you say. But it's important to understand what the Constitution says. But go on.
Sure. No, you're absolutely correct about that. And yeah, so we'll come back to that aspect a little bit later because we should talk about that Hispanic thing some too because there's some real bad misconceptions out there about the so-called brown-black coalition that's going on. I got some stuff I want to share with you as to who's being racist towards who when it comes to this conversation. But something's very unique about us, the descendants of the Chattel slaves, that no other immigrant groups in this country have. On July 4, 1776, we were transferred from the jurisdiction, the ownership of the British Empire, into that of the United States of America. So therefore, years later, after the Civil War, and these people had been set free from chattel slavery, and they now were nobodies but needed to be citizenized, when these guys wrote those documents, I believe they had in mind, we are talking about these people who were under the jurisdiction of the United States on the very day that the United States was born. No other people have that. And that, and then when you read, if you go and read, folks, if you read the Civil Rights Act of 1866, Section 1, which is what gave rise to the 14th Amendment, Section 1, it clearly states in there who this law is meant for. It talks about the people who were in voluntary servitude and slavery and colored people and so forth and so on. However, it ends in Section 1 saying that we're to have a citizenship as is enjoyed by white citizens. That's the constitutional law. Now, Section 2, folks, check this out. This blows away everything the Supreme Court or anybody, Obama or anybody, says or does about illegal immigration. Section 2 says, and be it further enacted that any person who, under the color of any law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom, shall subject or cause to be subjected any inhabitant of any state or territory to the deprivation of any rights secured or protected by this act, or to a different punishment, pains, or penalties on account of such person having at any time been held in a condition of slavery or involuntary servitude, it shall be a crime, right? In other words, whatever the Supreme Court rules, if it undermines Section 1 of the Constitution of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, it is unconstitutional. This whole birthright citizenship thing, that's a custom. It's not a law.
Right.
And the problem that people are having, John, is that they're saying, well, you're right, but we can't deport all of those people. Well, you know what? Some boys in Gettysburg, at Antietam, that Civil War, they gave their life, their blood, for these chattel slave people to be free, not for illegal aliens. And if our boys, them white boys, them black boys, had to suffer in that war for us, then they're going to have to suffer too by going home. Because if they stay here, particularly under the birthright citizenship custom, we, the chattel slaves, will be utterly destroyed, because that which was meant for our life, the 14th Amendment, has now been turned to the destructor of our life, the destroyer of our life.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying there?
I understand what you're saying. But, Ted, let me challenge you a little bit. I think that you and I would both agree that the border needs to be secured, and that the relentless influx of illegal immigrants is it's a security problem. It's an economic problem. It's to a certain extent, it's even a cultural problem, because we have people coming here who don't necessarily have much education or much access to it, and so they create their own conclaves and communities within the American structure, and they don't assimilate. So there's all different levels of instability that comes from illegal immigration, and I think that, well, certainly not everybody, but I think you and I at least could agree that the border needs to be shut down for that to be dealt with. But when it comes to the subject of deportation, we have about 12 million illegal immigrants living in this country, and you have been very outspoken about this. I think I might have read a Wall Street Journal article that cited you as one of the most effective black critics of illegal immigration, and your stance is well known. But given the fact that these people came here, albeit illegally, fleeing a difficult situation in Mexico, a country that is riddled with crime and poverty, and all sorts of terrible circumstances, is it possible for us to try and show them some leniency, those who have been here for some time, like Newt Gingrich was suggesting, that those who had borne down roots in the community, who have established themselves here, is there any way we can make any allowances for those people, or is total deportation the only logical policy?
No, you cannot make allowances for them. It's got to be zero tolerance. Abraham Lincoln had zero tolerance when it came to this issue of protecting the chattel slaves and bringing them into the full citizenship that they are supposed to have. You got to remember something. In the Declaration of Independence, the founding fathers, you started your conversation off a while ago about these white guys, okay? Yeah, these white guys put together a pretty powerful document. But what they did, though, was they implicated God in the Declaration of Independence and made him the central figure. And they made these great platitudes, all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights of life, that among these are life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Now, these white guys, these Americans, went to war with the mother country, killed a bunch of people, shed blood, claim that they were slaves, tax slaves, and they made a covenant with God, basically saying, God, we will free these people. That, I mean, we're talking about oppression, yet we got our boot heel on the back of another people's neck, holding us as living property. So if you bless us and help us to beat this empire, then we will free the slaves. Well, of course, they didn't do it. And Jefferson warned, if you don't do it, God's going to judge the country. And showed up, the Civil War came, and the country was severely judged. Now, it wasn't until Abraham Lincoln decided in 1862, 150 years ago, this season, that they decided that the war was not about big government versus states' rights or politics or the economy, but it was about the freeing of another people from the tyranny of chattel slavery, because God wanted it so, according to the Declaration of Independence. When they did that, the Emancipation Proclamation, everything changed for the Union. Well, 150 years later, why has this God that we're supposed to be united as one under, the Judeo-Christian God, why has he ordered or allowed this country to have a Barack Obama, a socialist invasion, illegal immigration, the Muslim incursion, our young people are losing themselves, drugs, alcohol, war? Why is America in such great debt? Because if you read the Bible, and see, I have to say that Reverend Wright was right. His attitude wasn't, but what he was saying was absolutely correct. It's in the Bible. You see, so for us as Americans to suddenly get soft and say, well, we got to help these people. No, they came here legally. You know, well, we got to give. No, because if you do that, if you yield to your emotions, you're going to offend God. You're going to offend him. Because
you wouldn't look at it as an issue of Christian compassion, Ted.
Well, Christian compassion would be no. Christian compassion would be help your neighbor get his house back. Mm-hmm. See, one of the things that I'm proposing to my Spanish Latino friends and to the campesinos and compañeros that I know of, I would like to see a revolution in Mexico and Central America and Guatemala, a civil rights, human rights revolution that we Black folks with American patriots and the Hispanic, Latino, illegal immigration people birth and spawn that movement here in America. We give them sanctuary from the federales and from the cartels, and we train them, we teach them. We then send them in teams back into Mexico through Central America, beginning to teach their people. And here in this country, we Black folks and white folks, Hispanics, Latinos, we march publicly against the corruption in Mexico and Central America. We march against the corruption of the United States and greed of Wall Street, and we begin to proclaim a message of deliverance for our people in Central America. And believe me, the campesinos and the compañeros will rise up, and we will take back Mexico and Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua. That's what I see to do. But see,
yeah,
I
can agree with the spirit of that. There needs to be solidarity shown between us and
sure
here and people in Latin America who's
sure
deprived of their rights, because that adds to so many of our problems here.
But they can't. They can't have ours. We can help them get theirs.
I understand what you're saying. Ted, I want to actually take this opportunity, because you've talked about these things in the context of our religious karma, so to speak, that we are reaping what we have sown because we have not abided in what the Bible commands, what God commands. And I want to take this opportunity to pivot to the Black church and the centrality of religion in the Black community. You've talked about how America has experienced, however, so many ills, because we have not been faithful to our founding principles, and in that biblical principles. What therefore is the position within the Black community of the Black church ideally? What should the Black church be doing in the Black community right now? What role should it serve, and what role is it serving in actuality today?
I think that the black church, whatever that is, and whoever that is, need to apologize to our youth. That lost generation of young people out here cutting the fool that they always talk about, that Bill Cosby always wants to castigate, and Mayor Nutter did September over there in that big church in Philadelphia. You know, they need to apologize to that so-called lost generation, because those kids did not lose themselves. That generation lost these children, these preachers, and they need to own up to that first and foremost and repent to God and apologize to these young people and reset and start all over. Secondly, I think they need to educate themselves on what we've been talking about here about our constitutional our rights. They need to start teaching it to our young people. And thirdly, they need to build a body politic, an organized effort where white folks or anybody else, the government, who want to help our people, they have a partnership to work through. For example, let's say Barack Obama came to a census and said, all right, black folks, we decided that we're going to give you our reparations.
Right.
And we're going to give it to you in the form of cash, in-kind resources, and so forth. We ready to go. It's up to $20 trillion. We don't care. We're tired. We want to get this fixed. Who would I make the check out to? Who would I talk to? Can y'all show us a business plan? Who will be accountable for these funds? There's nobody in the community.
As an aside, do you believe that we should receive monetary reparations for the crime of chattel slavery?
No, that's not my. Some people would say that, you know, but my main issue with reparations is that there's got to be a spiritual healing first and foremost. Be between black people.
Right.
Our wound did not begin in America. Our wound began on the mother country, mother continent. That's where the reparation must begin. In fact, I work with a guy, you need to have him on your show sometime. His name is Leo Alexander.
Leo
Alexander. He's come up with a plan where reparations begins in Africa. He says at the scene of the crime, and then you work your way back. That would mean Africa, Mecca, the Vatican, then Spain, Portugal, Spain, England, Europe, United States is last on the list to make a reparations.
Yeah,
of any sort.
I get the sense that we could pursue that subject all the way back to antiquity. But on the subject of the black church today, of course, back in the 60s, we had a great black preacher who led us in our most significant, one of the most significant eras of our social movement, the civil rights movement. We had the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. We had sort of a, if not a theological unity, at least a cultural unity.
No, we didn't. We had nothing. We failed. Dr. King failed. We failed.
How would you say
he failed?
Dr. King failed.
He failed. I'm not saying he was a bad guy. I'm not saying he was a bad guy. He was a great guy. I love Dr. King, okay? Yeah, I'll smack you about Dr. King.
I understand that, but we have legal equality under the law. That doesn't mean we always have it in practice. But on the books, we are equal to white people. We have greater economic prosperity. We're still poor, of course, but we have greater ownership of businesses now because of the rights Dr. King fought for. We have greater levels of education because of the rights Dr. King fought
That's
for.
That's a myth. Those are urban myths. Those are all urban myths. Those are the people who are in what Webb Du Bois called the talented tenth. That's an urban myth. If you look at statistics, we are worse off today as a people than when Dr. King marched in 1963. All statistics are pointing to that direction. All studies, Urban League, UCLA, the United Way, they're all saying we are worse off today than 1963. Now check it out. Dr. King said in 1963, on August 28th, at the march there in Washington, D.C., in the Lincoln Memorial steps, he said right at the top of his speech, people go read it again. You didn't hear him read it. He said, 100 years later, after the Emancipation Proclamation, January 1st, 1863, 100 years later, four times he said it, the Negro still is not free. Now, you combine that with the last 45 years of failed social economic policies, of welfare programs, the fact that we kill more black folks today than we've ever killed throughout the whole history of slavery, the fact that we lead in every negative social statistic except for teenage suicide, the fact that we are twice the unemployment rate of white folks says we have not gotten better, we have gotten worse.
Well, all of the latter things you said are true, but the idea that they're not as many college graduates among black people now as there were back in the 60s. Ted, I think that that's incorrect. Say that
what's it doing? What
were back in the 1960s. That's correct either, Ted. I mean, you're right. We have a miserable situation on our hands, of course.
But those
have not even increased marginally for our benefit from the 1960s. Do you really think that's fair?
What are those college-educated Negroes doing?
Okay, but that's
why
okay.
I used to lecture at Dartmouth College. Okay, every year I would lecture over there in New Hampshire, okay? In Hanover, New Hampshire, to the Black Student Union. Okay. And we'd have this very conversation. Okay. And them young people said, "Now, Mr. Hayes, you know, when I get out of school, man, you know, I'm gonna help my people." When you get out, you're going to keep on running. You're going to join the 1960s black brain drain, the black flight from our people running from niggas. Y'all going to leave us. No, I promise you. Man, them Negroes never came back. All the Pi, Delta, Kappa, man.
Okay, well, on that point, I can't argue.
Yeah, so what's the good of education?
It's not so much that. I think it's not so much that people are not educated in the official sense of getting degrees, not as many as should be, but I think there's been a positive increase in that area. But if you're going to tell me that they're not doing much with that education in terms of for black people, that instead they're running to mainstream society to find monetary success and leaving the rest of black people behind, I think you'd have a lot of people listening to this show who would nod their heads in agreement, because it seems as if black people, when they get a little bit of success, and I'm certainly not talking about everybody, but it seems like there's a trend among many to want to jump ship, and I think that that's what you're talking about.
But, brother, hold on. Now, in their defense, okay, I'm so damn complicated. In their defense, though, you can't blame them. You can't blame them for blaming them niggas, okay? You're from Los Angeles, right? Okay, you go out to the once upon a time black neighborhood, right? And you look at the houses in Compton and Inglewood and South Central, all the doors and the windows got bars on them. Bars weren't there to keep no Mexican illegals out, or the white man, or the police, or the KKK. Don't keep them niggas out the house. So when a brother makes good, the first thing they want to do is get away from them.
Right.
Now, they'll come back every now and then to, you know, floss, you know, and bling a little bit and throw a check here and there. But they moved to Hollywood, North Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Snoop, all them cats, man. See, and that's the problem. And check this out, okay? Then when we fuss about the illegal aliens coming into South Central, taking it over, but what are they taking over? Empty houses. Who, black folks, where did black folks go? They moved out to Riverside and Lancaster. And what's going on out there? Gang banging.
Hey,
listen, man. Someone one time came down to L.A. to a meeting we're having over at Lucy Florence's coffee shop. And they came down from Santa Clarita. And they were fussing about the white folks up there are racist and prejudiced against them. Some of them, you know, doing Ku Klux Klan stuff at them and whatnot, right? And they wanted us to come up there and help them. And I sat there and I had to bite my tongue, brother, because I got beaten up. Because I want to say, you know what, I don't blame them for not letting y'all in. If you're from South Central, it ain't got to do with color. It ain't got to do with race. It's got to do with your culture. Now, if you fix that stuff up in South Central, then you want to move up here? Come on. Because everywhere y'all have gone outside of L.A., crime and gangbang has gone up.
Yeah, I lived in Victorville for a little while, moving back out to California from Colorado, and it was pretty remarkable because a lot of black folks and some Hispanics too, to be fair, moved out there from the inner city, from South Central Los Angeles. And one thing you notice is you see out in this place, which is sort of you would sort of expect it to be Hickville, and part of the phrase, of course.
Yeah, I understand. You're just being bigoted towards country people, brother. I heard that.
I'm not being bigoted.
Nah, you're all right. Don't worry about that.
Look, I'm white. I'm white too.
Okay, there you go.
So either way I go, I'm talking about family, so I can get away with it a little bit. But one of the things I was amazed to see was that I saw a lot of people, you know, rocking colors. There's a lot of set tripping in Victorville between black folks and other minorities, and I'm thinking, how did this stuff get out here? But of course, it's what you said. There's sort of been an exportation as economic opportunities have dwindled in certain places. People are jumping ship, but they're taking this culture of violence with them. But that leads me to the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is culture. People listening to us right now who are familiar with my words, my articles, know that, in my opinion, one of the biggest illnesses to plague Black community today is a dearth of cultural values, a dearth of art that I think reflects things greater than materialism and over sexualism and violence and so forth. I think those listening to us already have a sense of how you might explain it, but how would you identify the state of Black culture today, and how is that effectively remedied?
It's destructive, brother. It's the slave quarters. Nobody cares what goes on in the slave quarters, not even the slaves themselves. Look at us. See, one thing I've learned now over the years, I began to look back on the integration segregation movement. I now understand the segregationists. Most of them were not racist. They weren't racist. They were culturalists. They weren't against us because we was Black. They were against us because of the culture that we had developed in the slave quarters that nobody cared about correcting. And they didn't want their daughters and their sons and to be contaminated with that. You know, and it has nothing to do with race. I mean, sure, there were those who used race as an excuse, but it was mostly cultural. You're looking for example, white folks in Appalachian Mountain. When's the last time you heard about white people in Appalachian Mountain? Poor-ass white people in Appalachian Mountain. You don't. And if you give one of white folks don't care about them folks out there, okay? And if someone's what they call white trailer trash, moved in your neighborhood, you don't want them in your neighborhood. White folks do not want to be around poor-ass white folks. That's just the way it is. Our skin just happened to be Black. You look at today. I was in England, rather, Australia.
Yeah.
Little white cats walking around with their pants sagging down behind their butt cheek. In the lower half of the butt cheek, hats flipped to the side. Here's a little white boy. He wanted to do some rapping with my sons, right? So we set him up. We got the music going. First thing out of his mouth, nigga, I'm a half a nigga. I said, whoa, wait a minute, cat, what you doing? New Zealand. They were saying, the kids in this lady was telling me, in Auckland, New Zealand, you got Bloods and Crips, white boys, Bloods and Crips.
Oh,
we saw it in Ireland, England, Greece. It's around the world. It's up in the Tibetan Mountains. Where did that come from? That comes from us, our culture. There's nothing for us to be proud about in that culture. You listen to our music, it's about nothing but about sex, bumping and thumping and grinding, these rappers, brother.
Yeah, for,
you know,
for whatever cultural problems we may have had back in the 60s, I mean, I look back on that time in the 50s prior to as being really, in many respects, the glory days of Black music and Black art. Doesn't mean there's nothing good today, even in the area of rap and hip-hop.
But that culture that I lived in the 50s and 60s, as much as we want to glorify, that culture is the parent of this one.
Well, of course. I mean,
and that culture, that parent of this one, was that of the 40s and 30s. Look at those guys in the 40s and 30s and the 20s and on back into the 90s, on back to where the slave quarters on the plantation. That's why when I hear immigrants say to us, get your act together, I say, man, what are you talking about? You came on the Mayflower. You can't talk to me like that. And I refuse. This is the attitude I'm taking now, folks. And I think you should join this attitude. We got to stop taking that from these folks and tell them, wait a minute, you don't talk to me like that, immigrant. If it wasn't for me, my people, upon our back, this nation is built. I can't stand right here, Obama and Bush and all the people, Condoleezza Rice and them say, this is a nation of immigrants. No, it ain't. It's a nation of immigrants built on the back of slaves. And without us, the immigrants could not come here. And it's time, I believe, if I get the juice, God willing, I'm going to start making demands that every immigrant in this country learn to know who we chattel slave people are and start respecting us. Or get the hell out of the country. I mean, that's the attitude. I want them to feel the heat. I want them to feel the heat of Ham on them.
Right. Well, we know where Ted Hayes is on that. But on the issue of culture, of course, it makes me think of in fact, I think you mentioned W.E.B. Du Bois.
Excuse me. I'm not talking about illegal immigrants. I'm talking about immigrants, those who came here legitimately.
Okay.
In a way, them cats are worse because they come here and they don't respect us at all.
Okay. I hear what you're saying. You mentioned Du Bois, the Talented Tenth, a while ago, and that's something we talk about, black is sometimes. And Du Bois seemed to recognize the fact that you could change a nation's perception of people, in this case black people, through our cultural exports, through our art and whatnot, through our music, through the things we put out that people perceive us through the lens of. And Du Bois and others, Langston Hughes, Arnabon Temps, different intellectuals and artists, produced the Harlem Renaissance.
Right.
And while you can argue about its long-term implications and how successful it was in one way or the other, I think that we would at least acknowledge that it gave broader America and the broader world a bit more of an elevated sense of what the black man is capable of intellectually and artistically and so forth. So, and you sort of hinted at, you did more than hint at it when you talk about the way people perceive us because of our culture today. But how do you remedy that culture? I mean, should we do what Du Bois did? Should we sponsor a different brand of art? Does it come through education? Does it come through the church? I mean, how exactly do the children of the chattel slaves rise above what some might characterize as the degeneracy of our cultural exports today?
The first thing we have to do as a people is create a body politic where you have a group of men and women, almost like a think tank, but with authority. They begin to pull together the brightest minds across the country and the world, spiritually, economically, socially, culturally, all those things. Because I don't have all those answers, but I do know this, those answers and those people out there do exist. We need to be able to magnetize and bring them together. That's step number one. Until you do that, you can come up with a program. I can come up with a program of re-education, whatever, but it's not going to be fast enough, and it's just going to turn into another social service program that you and I will get wealthy off of. But we'll help a handful of folks, but we're not going to help the body mass at all.
Right.
And that's what's been going on too long. And that's a culture in itself. Helping black people is a culture.
Well, of course, absolutely. So in other words, something sort of along the lines of what Du Bois pioneered might be in order for us today.
Well, yeah, but we got to. Who's going to administrate it? We got to have some sort of administration to pull it off, to bring in the resources to do all those things that we want to do. Like again, Obama said, "I got money for y'all. Who do we make the check out to?"
Right. Did you ever happen to see that episode of Dave Chappelle back when he was on, where black people got reparations?
No, I didn't see that.
In the skit, black people get reparations.
Uh-huh.
Simplify it. And everybody's very happy about it at first. Black people are happy about it. The
uh-huh.
next day, white people are happy about it. Because
uh-huh.
black people have turned around and given all the money buying Cadillacs and clothes.
Yeah. And that's why I believe in this country, somebody, white folks particularly, who do know who we are probably the main ones who are resisting the idea of a reparations at this time, because they know if they did it, if they could do it, it'll be squandered, it'll be destroyed. These people are not ready. See, and this is why.
I'm not in favor of monetary reparations myself for a certain reason.
How are you going to do it?
I tend to think that the people in the government, rather than being concerned about our readiness for it, are probably more concerned about just parting with the change, I think. But I hear what you're saying, and I wanted to ask you in our final segment here about politics and about its relationship to culture, and does our political culture need to change? I get the feeling that you might say yes, but I want you to elucidate for us, how is it that our politics today is part of the disease of our circumstances, if in fact you think that it is? And if so, how should our attitudes begin to adjust?
Well, you know, I'm dropping out of elected politics.
Mm-hmm.
I've paid my dues in that.
For those of our listeners who don't know, Ted Hayes actually challenged Maxine Waters in 2008 for her seat in Congress. Of course, Maxine Waters isn't going anywhere, heavily Democratic district, like the 35th. But Ted has some experience in elective politics.
Yeah, and I've also ran for city council, and I've ran for mayor in 1993.
I didn't know.
Yeah, ran for mayor in 1993, and didn't do too bad. I did better at that than I did against Maxine Waters, actually.
Yeah.
But and I don't blame Maxine Waters. I blame the Republican Party, which I'm through with, by the way. I am Republican, but I've quit the Republican Party or what they call the Republican Party. And I think they were more afraid of me than they were Maxine Waters because we could have beat her. We could have beat her.
So Ted Hayes is no shill for the Republican Party.
No more. No. In fact, my first action of civil disobedience in September is going to be against the Republican Party.
I see.
I'm going after them.
You've had a change of heart about the Republicans.
I'm sorry?
You've had a change of heart about the Republican Party.
Republican Party. But I am a Republican. I'm a radical Republican. I'm an 1854 Republican. Republicans had only one purpose, that was to free the chattel slaves, according to the Declaration of Independence, and bring them into full citizenship. If they own businesses, railroad, Wall Street, whatever they do, it should have been for the benefit of bringing the free chattel slaves into full citizenship. And they didn't do it. They abandoned us in 1877 when Rutherford B. Hayes, who was the Republican president, was up against Samuel B. Tilden of the Democrats, and Tilden won the Electoral College, Hayes won the popular vote, and they made a deal. And the deal was if Hayes, as president, would pull the troops back to the garrison in the South to protect the free chattel slaves from the Ku Klux Klan and so forth, that they would give him that vote. And he did. He sold us out. And Republicans never said another word after the Democrats Jim Crowed us for 99 years. Republicans didn't say a doggone thing about it. Because they were not Republicans.
So
the only Republican that did anything about it as president was Dwight David Eisenhower. He was the best thing since Abraham Lincoln.
When he integrated the armed services, you mean?
No, that was under Truman, but Eisenhower had a lot to do with that. Eisenhower, when he became president, he was the one that, along with the U.S. Chief Justice out here in California, they're the ones who pushed through Brown versus the Board of Education, which broke the segregation laws for schools in the South. And then he also sent troops into Little Rock, Arkansas. He sent federal marshals down to destroy the Ku Klux Klan. He wrote the framework for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He drove the illegal aliens out of the country, knowing that was going to hurt us. So this is stuff I didn't know about Eisenhower until within last year I began to dig this stuff out about him.
Okay. Thank you for the history. I think that's good for people to know.
Yeah, people don't know these things.
That's funny.
But
I didn't know as well. Hayes, Mr. Hayes, in our last few minutes, because I people have a sense, of course, of your attitude towards President Obama, but I think that people don't really have a sense of your attitude towards the differences between the parties in general. Today, is there any point in black people voting in this upcoming election? We always, I mean, I've always thought it was important to vote, of course, and we think of it as our civic obligation. But do black people have a genuine choice between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney? And if so, would you throw your support one way or another? And how would you explain it?
No, we don't have a choice. We never did. We never did from the very beginning. We don't have a choice. No, and I'm not voting for Mitt Romney. I'm not voting for Barack Obama. We need a charismatic, forceful, visionary leader, male or female, with a group of people around that person to form a body politic. When we do that, then we can tell black folks, all right, chattel slaves, we are going to vote together, and you have the Democrats and Republicans knocking at our door again.
Amen, brother. I think that you hit it right on the head. Mr. Hayes, I really appreciate you being with us today, and I think that our audience learned a lot. Now, of course, where they come down on any one thing or the other is up to them, but I do hope that you'll come back and join us sometime in the future, because this has been an edifying conversation. And once again, we thank you for being with us.
I would love to come back, and please spread the word about me across the country that there's a new voice, a voice for the chattel slave, not for black people, not for African Americans, not for Negroes, but for the descendants of the chattel slaves. If you're a chattel slave descendant, I speak for you. Get me out there, would you?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And your website is www.tedhaze.us.
Yes, sir.
And you can find The Other Side of the Pyramid available at, again, www.tedhaze.us.
Or go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com.
Or Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com. Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, brother. We look forward
to
talking to you again soon.
Thank you. Bye.